For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We are in a study of the Gospel of Mark. We're in chapter 6, verses 30 through 44 tonight. And we're going to talk about another dimension of the Gospel. We've been talking about how Mark begins the Gospel by saying the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, and that that Gospel continues on, and that every dimension, every little narrative that Mark talks about is just a putting together, another lens, another way of viewing this good news that God has offered to us in Jesus Christ. We're going to take another look at that. All right, so Mark 6, verses 30 to 44. Let's just, it's kind of a lot of reading, so I'm going to just get right down to it. The apostles, it says, returned to Jesus from their ministry tour and told him all that they had done and taught. And Jesus said, okay, now let's go off by ourselves to a quiet place and rest for a while. And he said this because there were so many people coming and going that Jesus and his apostles didn't even have time to eat. So they left the boat for a quiet place where they could be alone. But many people recognized them and saw them leaving. And people from many towns ran ahead along the shore and got there ahead of them. And Jesus saw the huge crowd as he stepped from the boat. And he had compassion on them because they were like a sheep without a shepherd. And so he began teaching them many things. Late in the afternoon, his disciples came to him saying, "This place is remote, and it's already getting late. Send the crowds away that they can go to the nearby farms and villages and buy something to eat." But Jesus said, "Better idea. You feed them." "With what?" they asked. "We'd have to work for months to earn enough money to buy food for all those people." "How much bread do you have?" Jesus asked. "Go and find out." And they came back reporting, "Well, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. And Jesus told the disciples to have the people sit in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of 50 or 100. And Jesus took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and he looked up toward heaven, and he blessed them. Then, breaking the loaves into pieces, he kept giving the bread to the disciples so that they would distribute it to the people. He also divided the fish for everyone to share, and they all ate as much as they wanted. And afterward, the disciples picked up 12 baskets of leftover bread and fish. A total of 5,000 men and their families were fed from these loaves. And so here we have the famous story of the feeding of the 5,000. This is one of the few things in the Gospels, all four Gospels, one of the few events that are recorded in all of them. And so this was obviously a very important event in Jesus' ministry. And just a couple of observations as we get into it. Basically, what we're talking about in a story like this is the principle of supply and demand. Isn't that right? And they're learning something here, a valuable lesson about supply and demand, that on the one hand, we have real limits. These disciples had real limits. I mean, think about it. They're tired. They're hungry. They are, in an expression, they're peopled out. And so they've been out doing this thing. They've been going off in pairs, and they're walking around the countryside. And, you know, they're taking on this message that Jesus commissioned them to do. And they come back and they're just full of stories and full of things that had happened. And no doubt they just can't wait for that opportunity to debrief with Jesus and get his input on all the things that they had seen and done. And they're tired. You know, remember Jesus had sent them out with 1 pair of clothes. So they're kind of stinky, with no food, with no money. And so they're coming back and they're tired. And they're tired also of being at places where they're the stranger and everyone's coming to them, and they're worn out and they don't have much to give. And even in terms of the food that they have, barely enough to even feed themselves. So here are disciples at a downtime in their life in some ways, with not that much by way of reserve. They kind of tapped out on that. And at the same time that there are real demands that are crowding in on them at all times. Now, Jesus is aware of their needs, and that's why he said, let's go off to this quiet place and, you know, get some alone time and recharge the batteries and stuff. But at the same time, the demands were there. And Jesus, seeing these crowds immerse around him, it says, has compassion for them because he says they're like sheep without a shepherd. And sheep are pretty stupid, and sheep without a shepherd, you know, that's a real problem. They're just going to stray off into all kinds of things. And so Jesus, the good shepherd, as he calls himself, has compassion for the lost condition of humanity, the broken lives that make up these crowds. And so here, on the one hand, my disciples are tired out. They've got real need. They've got limits that they've exhausted. On the other hand, there are these people that just keep coming, and they're coming, and their needs are real too. And so what is happening is that two worlds are beginning to collide, the world of needy disciples and the world of this needy crowd, and the legitimate needs of the disciples are really being jeopardized now by these crowds. Legitimate needs. And here, so there's just sort of the context here is something that is relevant to all of us who follow Jesus Christ and want our lives to matter for what God's doing in the world. That we will find ourselves at places where our true needs, our legitimate needs, are conflicting with the real needs of other people around us. Where we are just without the reserves and without the capacities to deal with those problems. And Jesus, of course, he knew this all along. And he was ready for this because now's the time for them to learn an extremely important lesson. We're told in chapter 6, verse 52, at the end of this sequence, after the feeding of the 5,000 and after Jesus walks on the water, that they had not, that his disciples, they still hadn't gotten the message he was trying to convey through this episode of feeding the 5,000. In John, it's even clearer. In John chapter 6, verse 6, it says that Jesus had kind of allowed this situation to develop in order that he might test his disciples. So he really is wanting to go out there into this barren place where there just is absolutely no way that those disciples are going to have the tools to meet the need of the day in order so that they would learn an important lesson. And it's interesting in thinking about this story that all the four of the Gospels, they have the story in it, but in none of the four Gospels do they explain what Jesus was spending all day long talking to the crowds about. Isn't that odd? Well, it's not odd if the real important enduring value in the story has a lot more to do with what the disciples walked away with than what the crowds walked away with. And that is the point, that there's something important for us to learn about what does it mean to follow Jesus Christ and to live for him that come out of this story. There are three things, particularly in the narrative, that I want us to discuss a little bit here tonight. Before we get to that, I just want us to understand the situation, the circumstance. Here, these disciples like us, confronted by deep needs, real needs, you know, you have to be completely off your game and insensate in the heart not to realize that we live in a broken world, a world where there are people who are just struggling on so many different levels, whose needs are so acute. And we as people who care about God's love, people, are going to be confronted by those deep needs. But like these disciples, we're also going to be confronted by the inadequacy to meet those needs, and the inadequacy so often that we ourselves do not want to face. It's one thing to have inadequacies and to sort of shield yourself from really facing those things, and yet another to just have circumstances come out where you just absolutely know, man, this is totally out of my league. It's over my head. And God is saying to us as followers of him, that situation is a coming. And I do want to throw you into the deep end. And you are going to be in over your head. And that's my design. That's a purpose. And in that situation, we may face real temptations, as no doubt these disciples did, as I know that I have in my life, as I fear that many of you have and maybe are in your life even now. When we see the ocean of need around us, and we see how inadequate we are to the task, you know, there's a temptation there to sort of, you know, resent this. It's like, you know, well, who am I to meet these needs? I got this person in my life. I got this person I live with. And I'm not sure I'm the man for the task to love this child, to love this spouse, whatever it is, to love my neighbor. And that the level of need that's there just so far exceeds my capacities. You know, I sort of resent the fact that that I'm in this place. I resent the fact that it reveals my weaknesses and my limitations. Dudes, you like the fact that you've got strength, don't you? And most men especially are very sensitive about preserving that, working within the context and the framework of my strengths. That's why we like work so much, because we're good at that. That's why we shy away from relationships, because we suck at that. But the real needs around us are deeply relational needs, deeply personal needs. And it's real possible just to begin to sort of resent the thought that that's the direction that God is calling me in, because we know that we're not prepared. You know, we may step back and sort of have a duty orientation about the Christian life. Well, I'm doing the right kinds of things. Kind of like a wind-up toy. I'm just, you know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. But my heart's not there, and I'm just sort of putting on in an external way. I'm sort of showing that I'm with the program, but I'm in my heart, I'm not. I'm not engaged, and I'm just sort of dutifully walking through the motions. And no one can stay that place for very long. And what happens is we, in a fairly dismissive way, begin to retreat into ourselves. We find Christian fellowship to be a burdensome obligation, and the thought of being representative of Jesus Christ in this world to be something that is just so deeply undesirable, because it reveals these things, these inadequacies that I really do have. So we go underground, we retreat into ourselves, we may play church or something like that, but the reality is we're not in the fight anymore, and we just have become completely almost an irrelevance as far as the work of God through us is concerned. Now, surely, like me, many of you know exactly what I'm describing here. And you have found, in fact, that you've come to a place in your Christian life where maybe at the early stages things were natural, things were easy, things were refreshing and rewarding. And then it became a little bit more difficult when call to real Christ-like love became something more than you were able to do, and you began to just pit your resources against the need and walk backwards. And maybe you've been walking backwards for a really long time, so much so, in fact, that the thought of standing in there for Christ in a visible way, and to really lay down your life and to love your neighbor as yourself, things that Jesus calls us to, just seem like they're like, you know, that's great theology, but that's not where I live. That's not what really governs my thinking or my life. And man, I just think that we've all been at that place. Some of you are there tonight. We need to think about this. Some of you are going to be there maybe in a short period of time. This is a lesson that every disciple needs to learn. That's why it's in all of these gospels. So let's think about this. Three truths about discipleship. First, I'm sorry to say, it's not about you. And most people have an arrow that issues forth from themselves and arcs around and comes right back to them. And that's how we live our lives. That's the string, you know, that connects the dots. And what Jesus is laying out to these disciples when he says, you know, you go feed them, is he knows that for them to be able to feed these people, it can have nothing to do with them. Totally. So it's about entrusting to Christ what you do have. That's the important thing. It's not how rich are my resources, but where am I willing to put those resources? That's obviously what matters. It's okay to identify your fears. Philip says in John's account, "What is this among so many needs?" And indeed, what is this among so many things? And you may be looking at your life, the things that you fear about your inadequacies, your inabilities. And maybe you can list them off pretty quickly, you know, introvert. That's a negative right there when it comes to relating to people, right? I get all my energy from being alone and I'm stuck with all these people. What am I going to do? And I don't know as much as them and I'm not that articulate. And we may have a really long list of our deficits, and that those deficits really are there and they're just as real as trying to feed 5,000 people with five little cupcake breads and a couple of dried up fish. And if that's where our focus is, how deeply inadequate we are, and that's as far as the thinking goes, well, we'll be of very little use indeed. But identifying those fears is fine. It's okay to take stock and realize I'm a broken vessel, man. I'm a work in progress. I've got lots of deficits in my character and all kinds of stuff like that. Jesus is totally cool with that. What he's not cool with would be like a self-loathing, because that's not humility. To go from "I've got real deficits in my life" to "I suck and shouldn't be counted on," that is a step that God is not into at that point. The kind of a self-pity that comes with, see, this is the way I am, this is the way I've always been, this is just the way it is. You know, that's not God's way, and God has not said that. God is able to say, yes, there are some real issues in your life, some real shortcomings indeed. But those things do not define you, and nor are they something to which you are subject, as though somehow it's a straitjacket that defines the limitations of your life. And beyond that, it's an offense to God. It's an offense to God to say, I don't have anything worth giving to the real needs of other people around me. Well, who do you think made you? See? And this, so there's a real conflict for some of us between ourselves and God, where we feel paralyzed by our weakness and therefore refuse to then take that step of belief and trust in Jesus Christ. And that is a sin. That is a problem that is going to just continue to dominate your life, that God has made us free from, that we've got to be willing to take a stand in. Man, I remember this as an early Christian, a young Christian, early in my Christian life. So I had had an opportunity to live with some Christian brothers in a rooming house down there on 16th Avenue, and it was a kind of a difficult transition for me. These were all guys, you know, who they had been walking with God for a period of years. For me, it was more a matter of just a few months. These are people who were intelligent people, and they were serious about study, things like that. I was a numbskull who never really went to high school. So there was always that deep sense of inadequacy. And so when I would get out there and I would make mistakes, what would that do? That would just tell me, yeah, you know, you are a numbskull. Of course you are. And so I began to diminish whatever expectation might be there that I could actually do something with my Christian life. One of my roommates set me aside and he said, you know, it's about time for you to stop feeling sorry for yourself. And it's time for you to test the limits of who God's made you, to apply, you know, your mind. You know, you think you're stupid, but you don't even know that because you're not even using that thing on top of your shoulders. Let's use that. You think that you don't know how to relate to people because you just are sort of an antisocial person. Well, that's true. That's the way I'd lived my life. But they're like, you know, does that stop you from extending a hand to someone and saying, I'm glad to meet you, my name's Jim? Of course not. And so that is where, you know, there's responsibility there to respond to the person that we are at that moment of time, not to sit back and checkmate over our limitations, but instead to just yield whatever it is you have to God and say, this is who I am, God, and warts and all, you know, all my failures and limitations, you know me well, and I'm just saying, God, that I want to entrust who I am to you. I want you to have your way with me. And I realize I'm no big banana or anything like that, but I do want to be a part of the bunch. And so just have your way with me, God. And that, you know, that's something that we do. We come before God. It's a decision that we need to make. Where we just say, Jesus, you are my Lord. It is appropriate and you are worthy of my life. So just whatever I can bring to the table, it's yours to shape and to mold. That's all he's asking. That's all he's asking. It's not about you. It's not about your capacities. It's the question of where do I go with those capacities? Then, too, like these disciples, they bring a pretty paltry offering. I think you'd have to agree. You know, a few loaves of bread and a couple of dried up fish for 5,000 people. That's just not really that much. And maybe you can relate to that. Maybe that's how you feel about yourself. But having then yielded these things to Christ and have put them before him, what happens is that Jesus begins to just multiply out of that meager offering enough to meet and exceed, in fact, the needs of everybody who was there. It's amazing. It says at the end of the story that everybody ate and everyone had enough. So Jesus wasn't there with his little Boy Scout knife cutting little crumbs off of a little bread and breathing them into a crowd, or, you know, get a piece of the dust while it's there or whatever. You know, these people were filled with the food that was provided for them. And the disciples had this awesome experience of being able to participate in this incredible, miraculous work of God. They were energized by that. Can you imagine? You know, you bring this little offering over to Jesus, and he's got this Mary Poppins purse, and it just never ends. It's just coming out. And so you go to the crowd, and you dish up your stuff, and then you come back, and there's still more, and there's still more. And you're like, this is a pretty amazing thing. It's incredible. It's energizing to participate in what God has done. Here's this old question that everybody asks. Why is the Dead Sea dead? You know, the Dead Sea is the lowest place on earth. But nothing grows in the Dead Sea. You know why that is? It's got all these nutrients from the mountains around it, and they just flow to this place. It is rich with nutrients, but it's got no place to go. It's got no place to go. And so it just becomes this bubbling cauldron of chemical goo. And it's useless to support life. And in a very real way, you know, that is sort of the way it is for believers in Jesus Christ who have all of these resources being poured into them. The opportunity to be a part of Christian fellowship, to have the very thoughts of God expressed to us through his word, access to him through our prayer and so forth. These are great things. We love that fact that that's what God, the kind of life that God has for us. But if that does not issue forth then in an outwardly oriented life where we are participating with the things that God is doing in this world, our lives, like the Dead Sea, is just going to be a stinking swamp of chemicals. And how unappealing that is. Instead, we give what little we have. We allow Christ to transform it into an abundance. And then we begin to, like these disciples, you know, just the pleasure of being useful. Pleasure of being able to be a conduit of reality and life and truth to people around us. How pleasurable that is. That's why people stay in the fight, and that's why people really get a taste for serving God. It's not because it's an obligation, but it's because it's so pleasurable to sense the power of God, you know, working through our lives to touch other people. Man, you could be into all kinds of things in this world, and nothing can compare to how beautiful that is. And a new kind of power. You know, here these disciples had this meager offering that multiplied thousands fold. And so it is in our own lives that God takes our inadequacy and our inability, and he just translates that into things that are so awesome and so powerful. So life-changing, so eternity-shaping. And so there's just something really awesome and beautiful being described here. And lastly, very poignantly, it says in verse 43, afterwards the disciples picked up 12 baskets of leftover bread and fish. Okay, so they fed everybody. Before Jesus transformed their loaves and fishes, they took a survey, and in the crowd they could find 5 loaves and 2 fish. But now, at the end of the story, the disciples themselves are walking away. They have these little baskets, you know, that's where they put the change of clothes, you know, water, things like that. It's the way they do it. And it's like, you know, at the end of the episode, after everyone's had their fill, they fill their own baskets completely full. They had many times in their own baskets what the whole crowd had cumulatively before this event. And so there's an abundance that Jesus is trying to describe to his disciples about what does it mean to entrust what meager things you do have to me. And there's transformation that you see in the lives of people who are prepared to just present themselves to Christ in this way. Real transformation. And sometimes, and I think very importantly, we begin to see as Jesus sees. You know, the disciples that came back from their tour of duty, they wanted nothing more than to be alone with Christ. And that was appropriate for them, of course. But Jesus saw something that they did not see. Jesus saw a crowd that was lost like sheep without a shepherd, and Jesus had compassion for them. That is something that begins to happen. Our vision becomes tighter. Our insight becomes greater when we're willing to yield what we have to Christ. When he begins to work through us, we begin to see things his way. We begin to take on his lens for the world. And you'll have the courage to see with compassion when you're convinced that the power we're dealing with has the ability to meet the needs around you. They were emboldened by that. When it comes to the description of the apostles in the book of Acts, these are powerful people whose lives have been touched and transformed by God. And that is how it works. As we're willing to step out and just give him what we've got, we see things his way, and we have the confidence of knowing that yes, God will accomplish his purposes through my life. Awesome. There's a change that affects how we feel, our affections, our values, as we present to him the things that we've got. And your life will change as you're elevated by the delight of participating in the work of God. I think this is one of the most important things for us to understand right here. That God is not pitting our own real true needs against the needs that he calls us to meet. He's going to use those opportunities, those circumstances where we're in way over our head, where the need far exceeds our capacities, to begin to change us. And our whole sense of what's important will begin to change when God does begin to affect work through us. And not because we just feel like he's got us in a half Nelson or something like that. It's because there's something so pleasurable, so delightful about being used by God, it's just like everything else that competes for my heart doesn't compare. Doesn't compare. And that delight creates real change. We begin to delight in things that we were afraid of. Okay, for me, yeah. Afraid of relationships. Afraid to be able to just initiate conversation with somebody. You know, and just to be able to be at ease and to be other-centered enough to be able to open my mouth. You know, for me, that was a very hard thing to do. I used to just sit there in the living room of our meeting house and I'd smoke on my cigarette and, you know, relate to it and, you know, no one else is really even out there or anything like that. That wasn't that many years ago. And there's been a little bit of improvement since then. Because in trusting God to just say, here's another person and God's got you occupying the same space, there must be a reason for that. To just move right on over in all of your fears and anxieties and stuff like that and just initiate conversation. You know, for me, that was, it was amazing because what happened was this. A conversation took place. And then another conversation took place. And then another conversation took place. And pretty soon, I'm actually looking forward to seeing that person come in again. Because there's a little bit of a connection there, a delight, an interest, a sense of satisfaction in cultivating that relationship. And not because I had to, but because it was just pleasing to yield to God what little I had. And that's just the way life works. And God will take you wherever you are, wherever you are. And he wants to give you the delight of being at that place where we are useful to him. And you will find that your whatever agenda, whatever track you're on, wherever you're trying to get your juice from, you know, and maybe you are somebody and you are the whatever, the be-all and end-all at your job, or maybe you're just so studly looking that everyone just buzz around you, or whatever it is that you rely on, fleeting. I wouldn't know about either one of those things, by the way. I'm not saying it's more hypothetical, but the point is, God's got something way better for you, way more powerful than your best game plan yourself. And it's just as we entrust ourselves to him in this way. There's a real significance that comes from being useful to the master like this, a growing sense of purpose for each stage of your life. My life is useful as a vehicle to affect the miraculous in the world around us. And I'm just amazed at every stage of life that I've been able to go through so far, from being single to being married to having children to losing children and so forth. You know, just that God has always got that crowd out there to be served. And that's true for all of us. I was talking to my mom two weeks ago now. She's 83. She'll be 84 next week. And she lives in this little condo community of octogenarians. And so they get their walkers out and, you know, they're doing this kind of thing. And she took Martha McCallum's book on God's incredible plan. She said, I got something that might be valuable for us to talk about instead of just gossiping in our little neighborhood group. How about finding out what God's purpose for our lives is before it's over? And they're like, that's a good idea, because people facing the end of their life want to know, what does it matter that I lived? And so now she's got this group of people that meet in her house every week, and they're reading this book, and they're finding God. And it's awesome. And every stage of life that we're in, every place that we are, God is saying, if you adopt my eyes, if you just see things the way I do, the curtain draws back, the needs are there. I have more than enough to supply what the needs are that are gathering around you. And you experience that, and it's beautiful. It's just like, man, this is why I was created. I like that a lot. I think that's awesome. That's the Christian life, right there. That's why it's in all four of these Gospels. Now, before we end, I want to just say one more thing. This coming from the Gospel of John, chapter 6, John's rendition of this story. He says, as he's kind of debriefing at the end, okay, he's fed the 5,000, he's done his thing, they go off, but the crowds continue to follow him, and he says in verse 26, I tell you the truth, you seek me not because you saw miraculous signs, but because you ate and were filled. He's talking to the crowds now, not the disciples. He says, don't work for the food that perishes. Don't work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you, for on the Son, the Father God has set his seal. And this is like a beautiful and a significant thing that Jesus is saying to this crowd. It's a different message. What is he saying? There is another kind of hunger that drives the hearts of men and women. And that hunger that really is there cannot be satisfied by any of the agendas that drive this world. And there is a kind of hunger where people are needy in their wealth. They have so much, but feel that they are just so lacking. There's a hunger that comes when a person feels alone and unknown, even in the context of relationships. Sometimes even in the context of marriage, unknown, alone. There's a hunger that comes when we have sought to pursue our pleasures and find that they don't satisfy. What were once vices are now habits. And now we just look to stimulation to feel normal, not even alive anymore. There's a hunger that comes when we have pursued greatness and accomplishments and have found at every turn when we have met the challenge and we have conquered the hill that we still walk away unfulfilled and we say, okay, well, what's next? And what's next? And what's next? And what's next? And the story is always the same. And some of us have pursued our hunger religiously. And if it's just doing the right thing, being more pious, maybe going to church, something like that, and yet still we feel empty. The directionlessness that so many of us have felt in the flurry of activities. Man, are we busy people, just zooming here and zooming there. Zoom, zoom, zoom. But then sometimes we step back and say, how come I'm doing this? You know, I'm running the treadmill pretty hard, but where am I going? And there's a hunger there. And that's exactly the kind of hunger that God has designed for us to be experiencing. Because that hunger then points us to the solution that Jesus gives. In verse 35 in John 6, he says, I am the bread of life. You can't have those deep needs, that deep hunger met by anything that you are capable of doing. I am the bread of life. And Jesus alone, he gives us himself. It is in him that deep hunger down to the core of our soul, yes, that can be met. That can be met by anyone, he says, anyone who comes to me. anyone. Doesn't matter what you did last night. Doesn't matter what your great accomplishments or shameful failures are. Anyone who comes to me, I've got food that will fill them up in a way that absolutely nothing in this universe is able to satisfy. Augustine, the great Christian writer of the 5th century, he put it like this. He says, the heart is restless until it finds its peace in God. No other substitute, no other way, right down to the core. You know, these people around Jesus, they say, what are the works that God requires? I'd like some of that bread. Just show me what I'm supposed to do. Show me what I need to accomplish. What are the works that need to be performed? Man, that's all what religion is. Tell me what I need to do to acquire the things of God. And I'll work it hard, you know. I'll be real pious as long as that bread just starts coming. And Jesus says something just so profound right here, doesn't he? He says this. He says, this is the work that God requires. You want to come to God on the basis of your accomplishments? Here's a feat for you. Believe in the Son who he sent. That's the work of God. That's what the Bible calls grace. Grace means God has done it all. Grace means, it's ironic, I think, Jesus is uttering these words during the festival of Passover. A year later, in Mark chapter 14, Jesus has his disciples together on the eve of the Passover. And he breaks this bread and he passes it around. And you know what he says to them? He says to them, this is my body that's broken for you. See, for Jesus to be the bread of life means that he is prepared to take that life and voluntarily take it all the way to the cross, to be broken, to be murdered, to die so that we don't have to die. He dies the death that we deserve. That's the whole point of the cross. Jesus took on himself the weight of all of our guilt. And so he's talking to us tonight. He's extending himself to us. He's saying, here's the work that God requires, that you believe in me, that you believe what I've done is adequate for you. And if you're prepared to believe that, and just to say, I bring nothing to the table. God, this is your thing that you've provided. I just want to receive as a gift what you offer me in your Son. Then he is the bread of life. And you will experience a new creation. You'll become new in him at that point. That deep longing in your heart that has driven you, you will find deep satisfaction in the reality of Jesus Christ in your life on the basis of grace, simply by the asking. Let's just pray together.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.